Well, I encourage you to have your Bibles open at that extraordinarily long text that was just read to us, Mark chapter 13. Now, soon we will be in our new church building. And I think I'm not alone when I say that we are keenly anticipating taking possession and moving in. Are you? Okay, good, good. So we're all excited. But you know, I want to ask you this question. What is your vision for St. George's? So it's going to be wonderful to have a building. But you know, in about a year's time, it will be like we've always had a building. And so I wonder, what is your vision for St. George's in 10 years' time? What kind of church would you like us to be? I understand the building is very good. I've only seen it from the outside. But I don't always trust Ray David, but I trust him. I'm wise, you know. But I trust him when he tells me that it looks great inside. And doubtless many of you are already saying to your friends, and will be saying to your friends, something very similar to what one of the disciples said to Jesus as they were leaving the temple. Did you pick it up in the reading? Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings. Are any of you saying that already? I'm sure we will be. And I would be one of the first to say that the building and the architecture are important. I think church architecture is very important because every day that that church stands, in one way or another, the architecture and the property will bear witness in that neighborhood. And thus it is very important that the architecture and the way we look after the grounds bear true witness day after day, night after night, to the Lord Christ. And so, yes, the building is important. But of course, far more important will be the life that develops in and around the building. Just as it was with the temple. Lord, look, what magnificent buildings. Now, you know, you won't understand Mark 13 if you don't grasp the significance of the temple in the history of the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the portable tabernacle and then the temple built under Solomon were the places, the royal palaces where God dwelt in the midst of his people. And you know, you've got to get a grip on that. Yes, God dwells in unapproachable light. And of course, no temple can ever contain this extraordinary God. And yet the Old Testament is absolutely clear that in the portable tabernacle and then in the temple, that God actually lived in the midst of his people. Now, you know, I'm a proud British citizen. And you are part of the Commonwealth. Oh, you are so blessed. And you know, in the United Kingdom, when the Queen is in residence at Windsor Castle, the flag flies at full mast. Why? Because she's rarely there. And see, in the tabernacle and then in the temple, it is though continually the flag of the King of Kings flies at full mast. Why? Because God, this infinite, eternal, holy, unapproachable God, dwells in the midst of his people. I've said this before, and I love this quote, but as one Jewish thinker has noted, once the tabernacle is there and the temple is built, God has an address on earth. That's the temple. His presence there was real. in all its extraordinary grace and humility, in all its terrifying holiness and therefore danger, the hunter, as C.S. Lewis says, the warrior, the king, right there in the midst of his people as their sovereign king to whom they swore allegiance and obedience. And when they were in the desert traveling towards the promised land, you could wake up in the morning and you would look over to the center of the camp, and there was the tabernacle with the cloud and then fire, God in your midst. And so too with the temple. You need to read about the consecration of the tabernacle in Exodus 40. Because there you will see what goes on with the tabernacle and then the temple. Exodus 40. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting. And listen to this. The glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle. And so powerful was this that Moses was unable to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. It would be remarkable if we were unable to enter the new building to consecrate it because God was so present. It's that kind of picture. Through all their journeys, when the cloud was taken up, the people would set out. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night. Fire! And so if we think of tabernacle, we think of glory, cloud, fire, God in the midst of his people. And then in 1 Kings 8, we read about the tabernacle being brought into the temple, which had been built by King Solomon. Exactly the same thing. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, but for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Cloud, glory. The house, the residence of Yahweh in the midst of his people. What a magnificent opportunity to live in Israel with God, the living God in your midst as your king. And the whole idea was that his people would live thankfully and obediently under his magnificent reign, so that the totality of their lives would be a glorious witness to all the nations of the world. Israel was intended to be like a people living in the land, with glass all round the land, so that the nations could come and they could peer in and they could say, "Oh my goodness." So that's what real human life looks like. Life with God in its midst. And this is why in Luke's gospel, when those naughty, I love the way Ray David says naughty. I can't do the Canadian thing, but it does sound very naughty when he says it. But, you know, those naughty parents, well, they weren't so naughty, were they? But they've gone with their son. Had a great time in Jerusalem. And then they're a day into the journey and they can't find him. Now, parents, do you feel the panic coming on? A horrific experience. You know, a missing child, there's nothing quite like it, is there? You know, it can be half an hour and it feels like 10 years. But so then they have to go all the way back and they search and they search. And you know, you may think Jesus needed a good hiding. With the response he made. But he says this to them, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" Now there, if you want to know what temple is about, my Father's house, This sums up what temple is all about. It's where the Father lives. It's his address. It's where he lives in the midst of his people. The temple was the place where you would go to meet with God, to offer your sacrifices to God, to hear his word taught to you by the priests, and to pray to God. And you know, in Israel, and this is something we need to rediscover, I think, Israel was a fairly big land, and of course not everyone could get to the temple every day. And so in the Old Testament law, it's compulsory for every Israelite to go on pilgrimage to the temple, compulsory pilgrimage, 3 times a year for the great festivals of the year according to Yahweh. And you think about that. You have to stop work. You have to take a week or two off. You break the rhythm. And you go to Jerusalem to reimmerse yourself in the great story of which you are part. And if you want to get a sense of what it was like to stop work in your town or your village, get the whole family and the extended family together and make your pilgrimage towards Jerusalem, the city of the great king, where God, your king, lives in the midst of his people, you should have a look at the Psalms of Ascent. In Psalms 120 to 134, these are headed Songs of Ascent. Why? They're a pilgrimage hymnal. They're a hymnal, songs to sing on the way to the city of the great king. And you will know some of these so well. The first one, or the second one, Psalm 121. I lift up mine eyes to the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And the city, Jerusalem, the Lord's temple, it's on a hill. I lift up mine eyes to the hills. Because the king who lives there, did you pick it up? He's the Lord of heaven and earth. He's not just the local God. He's not just the God of Israel. He is the God of the entire creation. And then Psalm 122, I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of Yahweh. Why? Because that's where my king lives. That's where I get my sins forgiven. That's where I get re-immersed in the story of which I'm part. Psalm 123 and verse 1. To you I lift up my eyes, O you who are enthroned in heaven. God in the midst of his people. An extraordinary vision. God living in his royal palace in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. And 3 times a year you would stop. You would leave your work and you would go off to one of the major feasts in Jerusalem, to recenter your life in the great story of which you were part, and then to return to your town or your village to live out that story more fully once again to the glory of the living God. Now, you will not understand Mark 13 unless you start to grasp the significance of the temple. The temple was the great symbol and the great reality of what Israel is and the God of, as the people of God were about. And it's only such an understanding that will enable you to understand the shock it must have been to the disciples when Jesus said to them, you know, once disciples just said, you know, Lord, what magnificent buildings. And Jesus says, do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. He prophesies the destruction of God's dwelling in the midst of his people. Not surprisingly, as they were sitting on Mount Olives, a very significant position, looking across the valley towards the temple, The disciples, a few of them, asked for a private time with Jesus. Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Well, I mean, you can understand the urgency. You know, God's house is going to be destroyed. You know, so imagine in 2 years' time we hear, oh, St. George's is going to be destroyed. Everyone be knocking at Gillian and Ray Day's door. When? What will be the sign? You know, they say, well, when you see the bulldozers coming, you can be sure. And it's that kind of question. And that's the question that governs this whole chapter. I should alert you, there's considerable disagreement about how to read Mark 13. Tom Wright says Mark 13 and its parallels have been the focus of fierce scholarly debate in discussion of the kingdom and the aims of Jesus. There's lots of difference of opinion on this chapter, and that's why Ray David assigned it to me. At least that's what Gillian told me. No, she didn't. Now, I read it, as Tom Wright does, not about the second coming, but about the destruction of the temple. Okay? I think it's a major judgment passage, so it has overtones of the second coming. But I think it's primarily about the destruction of the temple, not about the second coming. But there are lots and lots of scholars who disagree and who read it as about the second coming. So I'm just alerting you to that. Jesus is a prophet. He stands in this respect in line with the great Old Testament prophets. And one reason people think it's about the second coming is because of the extravagant imagery that Jesus uses. But I think he uses this to evoke the significance of the coming destruction of the temple. And in the Old Testament, this kind of imagery gathers around the future vision of the day of Yahweh. And there are many, many Old Testament passages from the prophets, from Daniel, that Jesus uses here to convey the significance of the destruction of the temple. And you must recognize that imagery, which is often a sort of catastrophic imagery, apocalyptic imagery, in order to bring home the enormous significance of the destruction of the temple. And this is typical of what the Old Testament prophets do. And I think it is a failure to recognize this imagery that makes many think this is referring to the second coming. Now, have a look in the passage at the sort of things Jesus says are going to happen. False messiahs will arise. So this evokes a notion of tremendous crisis. Whenever there's a crisis, messiahs arise. Do you remember when we were heading into 2000? There were lots of messiahs around. You know, I hope not many of you were stocking your underground bunker and so on and so forth, but those were, you know, it's all a crisis. And then this will be a time of terrible birth pains. And I think what Jesus has in mind here are the birth pains of the birth of the new Israel. This is a time of tumult among the nations. And I think this is evocative language, typical of Old Testament prophets, to alert you to the fact that theologically, the destruction of the temple is a huge event. It's a huge event. So this language is kind of hyperbolic language. Families will be divided against each other. I think this is a one-verse commentary alluding to Micah chapter 7. The abomination of desolation. You know, this is the desecration of the temple. The Son of Man coming on clouds. I don't think is a reference to the second coming, but I think it's a reference to the Son of Man successfully exercising judgment on the earth and going to the Father to report what he has done. And I think one of the verses that strongly supports this way of reading it is where it says, this generation will not pass away until all this has happened. Also, you know, the language of flee. Well, when Christ comes again, Christians don't need to flee. So this is about, you know, a judgment. And it's there's lots of interesting stuff here. You know, Jesus is going to go to the cross. But he says to his disciples, when this crisis hits, and it hit, by the way, in AD 70, 40 years after this prophecy, when Rome destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. Jesus says to them, when that happens, don't be a martyr. Get the heck out of here. Okay? You don't have to do what I'm going to do. So it's very, very interesting passage in all sorts of ways. And you know, you've got to think, the disciples, if you've been following Mark's gospel, with Jesus, shortly, not long ago, they arrived in Jerusalem. They were anticipating that somehow now Jesus would be enthroned as king. What they are learning now is that his kingship will be vindicated by the judgment and destruction of the temple. And so see, the story, Jesus is constantly struggling with this. There's the Old Testament story. There are all the Jews who were anticipating it coming to a climax in particular ways. So too did his disciples. And he's constantly having to reshape their understanding of the story to see it's different and it's bigger and it is far, far better. Now, if with Tom Wright we take this passage to be prophesying the destruction of the temple and showing us the significance of that judgment, why is this passage so important? Jesus is now, we're not far now from the cross. We're heading into the final stages of Jesus' ministry. If you have a look at Mark's gospel, the narrative slows down now. And a good storyteller always does that when he wants to alert you to, boy, this part of the story is really important. So why this? Several reasons that I conclude with. Firstly, because of the enormous significance of the temple as the symbol of God's presence amongst his people. I've talked at length about that. Secondly, because in the economy of God, the temple's days as the home of Yahweh are now over. That's the huge significance. God, to put it bluntly, and St. George's, you need to hear this, does not hang around forever when his people consistently disobey him and distort his purposes for them and his world. Sadly, as we know from the Old Testament, while there were many high points in the history of God's people, on the whole, the drift was constantly towards rebellion and a hankering not after Yahweh, but after other gods. And naturally, this hankering after other gods manifested itself in Israel's worship. And if you want to understand Mark 13, you've got to go back to Mark 11. Where shortly after Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he curses a fig tree because he can't find any fruit on it. And then he uses force to cleanse the temple, telling those who are there, "Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." Cursing a fig tree. The fig tree is a symbol of Israel, but there is no fruit. And where the people of God continually fail to produce fruit, judgment will come. God has been incredibly patient with Israel, but there is no fruit. And the house of prayer, my father's house, it has become a corrupt center for commerce rather than what God intended it to be, a house of prayer for all nations. And most significantly, and I don't know if you've picked this up, the son has come to his father's house, but those who are running the house want nothing to do with the son. If you read here, the response of the chief priests and the teachers of the law, those who ran the church office at the temple, they now begin to look for a way to kill Jesus. And so what does Jesus do? He reaches back into the Old Testament for the language used about the destruction of Babylon, the great enemy of God. And using that language, he declares that the judgment God brought upon Babylon will now fall upon the temple. It will be destroyed. This happened in AD 70. Fourthly, because a new era is dawning in the history of God and his world, God in Christ is building a new temple. In the New Testament, the individual believer is described as a temple of the Spirit, but so too is the church. And we see this in 1 Peter, for example, as you come to him, a living stone, rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. You are a chosen race. These are all the characteristics of Israel. They are now applied to the new temple, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. I asked you at the outset, what vision do you have for St. George's? And I say to you, here it is. The vision must be to be the temple of God, a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that in Alton Village we may be renowned as those who proclaim the excellencies of him who has called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. I suggest that we should have written over St. George's, cloud, glory, fire. But only if it's true. The building alone will not do it. And sadly, it's far, far from true of too many churches in Canada and in the West that there is no cloud, there is no glory, and there is no fire. And if you think that a church like St. George's will sail now into the blue yonder, never vulnerable to the judgment of God, like the temple, you should think twice. In Revelation chapter 1, we have a phenomenal image of what the church is like. A church is like a lampstand. And the one who is the Christ walks amongst his churches. And you know, a lampstand, I love that image of the church. because, you know, there's nothing that great about being a lampstand. you're ordinary. It's not the lampstand that counts. It's what it does that counts. But this is the great dignity of the church. We are to be the clay jars, the broken clay jars that carry the Christ light into the world. We are to be the lampstand that shines the light of the Christ into the darkness of Canadian culture. But you know, in Revelation, the letter to the Ephesians says this: I have this against you. You have lost your first love. Repent, or I will come and remove your lampstand from its place. Glory, cloud, fire. Another great name for St. George's would be Church of the First Love. But only if it's true. We need to be a people who are falling in love again and again with Jesus. We know not when Christ will return, but till then our calling is clear. You and I are really not that important. I love to tell my students, you know, in the Bible, heaven is God's throne, earth is his footstool. But that's the glory, to be the footstool of the great king. It's the great king that counts, but we are called to be the lampstand, the bearer, however inadequate, of the light. We are those broken clay jars shining the light of Christ into his world. Cloud, fire, glory, first love. I wonder how we will look in 10 years' time. Amen.